Hi, I'm Brian from Olathe, Kansas, and you're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio Program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Acre or anytime at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Upstate Films, a nonprofit theater presenting Sonic Wave, an ongoing music and sound-rich series screening in a new Atmos theater at the Orpheum in Socrates every Monday night. This month playing Goodbye Horses, The Many Lives of Q. Lazarus, Other Like Me, The Oral History of Coombe Transmissions and Throbbing Gristle, All Dolled Up, The New York Doll Story, and Heartworn Highways. Information at upstatefilms.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, once again, or maybe for the first time, you're tuned into Good Night Norman with your host, me, Norman Douglas, broadcasting to you live. I'm WGXC 90.7 FM here in the Mid-Hudson Valley, Catskill, Hudson, Acre, WGXC.org, and a lot of the rest of the world. Radio for open ears. Tonight, more fiction. I will tell you no lies. It's the 21st of April. It is midnight 03. And that means it's no longer Jesus' rebirthday or the birthday of that Austrian guy or the festival of cannabis. But it is the beginning of some astrological sign, I think. Maybe it was yesterday, too. Who knows? I'm not a zodiac type. Tonight, Roberto Bolaño. Or this morning, I should say. Chilean author. Exiled. This is a book of short pieces called Nazi Literature in the Americas. Bolaño was not a Nazi. He was, however, exiled from his homeland because of the U.S.-backed Nazi dictator Augusto Pinochet and his stooges. And the CIA and other glorious protectors of American democracy. This is a collection of fictions. Translated. By Chris Andrews, and published in New Directions. That's the edition I have here. Translation was in 2008. The original text was 1996. And I have a New Directions paperback. I'm going to read the first piece, Edelmira Thompson de Mendeluce. Buenos Aires, 1894 to Buenos Aires, 1993. presumably dates of birth and death and locations. At 15, Edelmira Thompson published her first book, To Daddy, which earned her a modest place in the vast gallery of lady poets active in Buenos Aires high society. And from then on, she was a regular presence in the salons of Jimena San Diego and Susana Lescano Lafinur, dictators of taste in poetry and of taste in general on both banks of the Rio de la Plata at the dawn of the 20th century. Her first poems, as one might reasonably have guessed, were concerned with filial piety, religious meditation, and gardens. She flirted with the idea of taking the veil. She learned to ride. In 1917, she met the rancher and entrepreneur Sebastian Mendeluce, 20 years her senior. Everyone was surprised when they announced their engagement after only a few months. According to people who knew him at the time, Mendeluce thought little of literature in general, and poetry in particular, had no artistic sensibility, although he did occasionally go to the opera, and his conversation was on a par with that of his farmhands and factory workers. He was tall and energetic, but not handsome by any means. There was, however, no disputing his inexhaustible wealth. Edelmira Thompson's friends considered it a marriage of convenience, but in fact she married for love, a love that neither she nor Mendeluce was ever able to explain, and which endured imperturbably all the days of her life. Marriage, which ends the careers of so many promising women writers, quickened the pen of Edelmira Thompson. She established a salon in Buenos Aires to rival those of the redoubtable Jimena San Diego and Susana Lescano Lafinur. She took young Argentinian painters under her wing, not only buying their work. In 1950, her collection of paintings and sculptures was, if not the best in the Republic, certainly one of the largest and most extravagant, but also inviting them to paint at her ranch in Azul, far from the madding crowd, all expenses paid. She founded a publishing house, The Lamp of the South, which brought out more than 50 books of poetry, many of which were dedicated to Edelmira herself, the, quote, fairy godmother of Argentinian letters, end quote. In 1921, she published her first book of prose, All My Life, an idyllic and rather flat autobiography, devoid of gossip, full of landscapes and poetic meditations. Contrary to the author's expectations, it disappeared from the bookshop windows in Buenos Aires without leaving so much as a ripple. Disappointed, Edelmira set off for Europe with her two small sons, two servants, and more than 20 suitcases. She visited Lourdes and the great cathedrals. She had an audience with the Pope. A yacht took her from island to island in the Aegean. She reached Crete one midday in spring. In 1922, in Paris, she published a book of children's verse in French and another in Spanish. Then she returned to Argentina. But things had changed, and Edelmira did not feel at ease in her country. Her new book of poems, European Hours, 1923, was described in a local newspaper as precious. The nation's most influential reviewer, Dr. Enrique Belmar, described her as, quote, an idle, childish lady whose time and energy would be better spent on good works, such as educating all the ragged little rascals on the loose throughout this vast land of ours, end quote. Edelmira's elegant reply consisted of an invitation to attend her salon, addressed to Belmar and other critics, which was ignored by all but four half-starved gossip columnists and crime reporters. Humiliated, she retired to her ranch in Azul, accompanied by a faithful few. soothed by the rural calm and the conversations of simple, hard-working country folk, she set to work on the new book of poetry that was to be her vindication, Argentinian Hours, 1925. This sparked scandal and controversy from the day of its publication. In her new poem, Zedelmira renounced contemplative vision in favor of pugnacious action. She attacked Argentina's critics and literary ladies, the decadence besetting the nation's cultural life. She argued for a return to origins, agrarian labor, and the still wild southern frontier. Flirting and swooning were behind her now. Edelmira longed for the epic and its proportions, a literature unafraid to face the challenge of singing the fatherland. One way and another, the book was a great success, but demonstrating her humility, Edelmira barely took the time to relish her triumph and soon left for Europe once again. She was accompanied by her children, her servants, and the Buenos Aires philosopher Aldo Carozzone, who acted as her personal secretary. She spent the year 1926 traveling in Italy with her numerous entourage. In 1927, she was joined by Mendeluce. In 1928, her first daughter, Luce, a bouncing 10-pound baby, was born in Berlin. The German philosopher, Haushofer, was godfather to the child. And the baptism, attended by the cream of the German and Argentinian intelligentsia, was followed by 3 days of non-stop festivities, which culminated in a little wood near Rathenau, where the Mendeluces treated Haushofer to a kettle drum solo composed and performed by Maestro Tito Vasquez, who went on to become a sensation. In 1929, the stock market crash obliged Sebastian Mendeluce to return to Argentina. Meanwhile, Edelmira and her children were presented to Adolf Hitler, who held Luce and said, "She certainly is a wonderful little girl." Photos were taken. The future Führer of the Reich made a great impression on the Argentinian poet. Before leaving, she presented him with several of her own books and a deluxe edition of Martín Fierro. Hitler thanked her warmly, beseeching her to translate one of her poems into German on the spot, a task which, with the help of Carazzone, she managed to accomplish. Hitler was clearly delighted. The lines were resounding and looked to the future. In high spirits, Edelmira asked for the Führer's advice. Which would be the most appropriate school for her sons? He recommended a Swiss boarding school, but added that the best school was life itself. By the end of the audience, Edelmira and Carazzone were committed Hitlerites. 1930 was a year of voyages and adventures. Accompanied by Carazzone, her young daughter, the boys were boarding at an exclusive school in Bern, and her 2 Indian servants, Edelmira traveled up and down the Nile, visited Jerusalem, where she had a mystical experience, or a nervous breakdown, which confined her to a hotel bed for 3 days. Then Damascus, Baghdad. Her head was buzzing with projects. She planned to launch a new publishing house back in Buenos Aires, which would specialize in translations of European thinkers and novelists. She dreamed of studying architecture and designing grandiose schools to be built in parts of the country as yet untouched by civilization. She wanted to set up a foundation in memory of her mother, with the mission of helping young women from poor backgrounds to fulfill their artistic aspirations. And little by little, a new book began to take shape in her mind. In 1931, she returned to the Argentinian capital and began to carry out her projects. She launched a magazine, Modern Argentina, edited by Carozzone, whose mission was to publish the latest in poetry and fiction, but also political commentary, philosophical essays, film reviews, and articles on social issues. Half of the first number was devoted to Edelmira's book, The New Spring, which came out simultaneously. Part travel narrative, part philosophical memoir, the book reflected on the state of the world and the destinies of Europe and America in particular, while warning of the threat that communism posed to Christian civilization. The following years were rich and productive. She wrote new books, made new friends, traveled to new places. Touring the north of Argentina, she crossed the Bolivian border on horseback, launched new publishing ventures, and diversified her artistic activity, writing the libretto for an opera, Anna, the Peasant Redeemed, 1935, whose premiere at the Teatro Colón divided the public and led to verbal and physical confrontations. Painting a series of landscapes in the province of Buenos Aires and collaborating in the production of three plays by the Uruguayan author Wenceslao Hassel. When Sebastián Mendelssohn died in 1940, Edelmira was unable to travel to Europe as she would have wished because of the war. Deranged by sorrow, she composed a death notice which took up a whole page in each of the nation's major newspapers and was signed Edelmira, the widow Mendelssohn. The text, no doubt, reflected her unstable mental state. It was widely mocked and derided among the Argentinian intelligentsia. Once again, she withdrew to her ranch in Azul, accompanied only by her daughter, the faithful Carozzone, and a young painter named Arilio Franchetti. I guess that would be a Franchetti, sorry. In the mornings, she wrote or painted. Her afternoons were occupied by long solitary walks or hours of reading. Reading and a bent for interior design gave rise to her finest work, Poe's Room, 1944, which prefigured the Nouveau Roman and much subsequent avant-garde writing, and earned the widow Mendelssohn an eminent place in the panorama of Argentinian and Hispanic letters. This is how she came to write the book. Edelmira read Edgar Allan Poe's essay, Philosophy of Furniture. She was excited. She felt that she had found a soulmate in Poe. Their ideas about decoration coincided. She discussed the subject at length with Carozzone and Attilio Franchetti. Following Poe's instructions to the letter, Franchetti painted a picture, an oblong room 30 feet deep and 25 feet wide, with a door and two windows in the far wall. He reproduced Poe's furniture, wallpaper, and curtains as exactly as possible. Pictorial exactitude, however, was insufficient for Edelmira, so she decided to have a replica of the room built in the garden of her ranch, in accordance with the directions given by Poe. She sent her delegates, antique dealers, cabinet makers, carpenters, hunting for the items described in the essay. The desired but only partly attained result consisted of large windows reaching down to the floor, set in deep recesses, window panes of crimson-tinted glass, more than usually massive rosewood framings. Inside the recesses, curtains of a thick silver tissue adapted to the shape of the window and hanging loosely in small volumes. Outside the recesses, curtains of an exceedingly rich crimson silk, fringed with a deep network of gold and lined with the same silver tissue used for the exterior blind. The folds of this curtain fabric, issuing from beneath the broad entablature of rich giltwork, encircling the room at the junction of the ceiling and walls. The drapery thrown open or closed by means of a thick rope of gold loosely enveloping it and resolving itself readily into a knot, no pins or other such devices being apparent. The colors of the curtain and their fringe, the tints of crimson and gold, appearing everywhere in profusion and determining the character of the room. The carpet of Saxony material, half an inch thick, of the same crimson ground, relieved simply by the appearance of a gold cord like that festooning the curtains, raised slightly above the surface of the ground and thrown upon it in such a manner as to form a succession of short, irregular curves, one occasionally overlaying the other. The walls, prepared with a glossy paper of a silver-gray tint, spotted with small arabesque devices of a fainter hue of the prevalent crimson, many paintings, chiefly landscapes of an imaginative cast, such as the fairy grottos of Stanfield or Chapman's Lake of the Dismal Swamp, but also three or four female heads of an ethereal beauty, portraits in the manner of Sully, each picture having a warm but dark tone. Not one of the paintings being of small size, since diminutive paintings give that spotty look to a room which is the blemish of so many a fine work of art overtouched. The frames broad, but not deep, and richly carved, without being dulled or filigreed. The paintings lying flat on the walls, not hanging off with cords. One mirror, not very large and nearly circular in shape, hung so that a reflection of a person in any of the ordinary sitting places of the room could not be obtained from it. The only seats being two large, low sofas of rosewood and crimson, gold-flowered silk, and two light conversation chairs, also of rosewood. A pianoforte made of the same wood, with no cover, and thrown open. An octagonal table, also without cover, formed altogether of the richest gold-threaded marble, placed near one of the sofas. A profusion of sweet and vivid flowers blooming in four large and gorgeous Sevres vases set in each of the slightly rounded angles of the room. A tall candelabrum bearing a small antique lamp with highly perfumed oil standing beside one of the sofas, upon which slept Poe's friend, the possessor of this ideal room. Some light and graceful hanging shelves, with golden edges and crimson silk cords with gold tassels, sustaining 200 or 300 magnificently bound books. Beyond these things, no furniture except for an argand lamp with a plain crimson-tinted ground glass shade, depending from the lofty vaulted ceiling by a single slender gold chain and throwing a tranquil but magical radiance over all. The argand lamp was not particularly difficult to procure, nor were the curtains, the carpet, or the sofas. The wallpaper proved more problematic, but the widow Mendeluce dealt directly with a manufacturer, providing a pattern especially designed by Franchetti. Paintings by Stanfield or Chapman were not to be had, but the painter and his friend Arturo Belasco, himself a promising young artist, produced a number of works which finally satisfied Edelmira's desires. The rosewood piano also posed a number of problems, all of which were eventually solved. When the reconstruction of the room was complete, Edelmira judged that the time to write had come. The first part of Poe's room is a derailed description of the same. I'm sorry, I said derailed. It's detailed. The second part is a treatise on good taste and interior design, which develops a number of Poe's precepts. The third part is devoted to the building of the room on a lawn in the garden of Edelmira's ranch in Azul. The fourth part is a meticulous account of the search for the furniture. The fifth part is a description of the reconstructed room, similar to but also different from the room conceived by Poe, with a particular emphasis on the light. The color crimson, the origin and state of conversation of various pieces of furniture, the quality of the paintings, every one of which is described without sparing the reader a single detail. The sixth, final, and probably briefest part is a portrait of Poe's friend, the dozing man. Certain, perhaps over-ingenious critics identified that figure as the recently deceased Sebastian Mendeluce. The book made little impact at the time of its publication. On this occasion, however, Edelmira was so sure of what she had written that the general incomprehension hardly affected her. According to her enemies, during 1945 and 1946, she made frequent visits to deserted beaches and little-known coves, where she welcomed the clandestine travelers arriving in what was left of Admiral Dönitz's submarine fleet. It has also been claimed that she financed the magazine The Fourth Reich in Argentina, and subsequently the publishing house of the same name. A revised and enlarged edition of Poe's Room appeared in 1947. It included a reproduction of Franchetti's painting showing a view of the room from the doorway. The sleeping man is dimly visible in profile. It could, in fact, be Sebastian Mendeluce. It could also be any heavily built man. In 1948, while continuing to publish Modern Argentina, Edelmira launched a new magazine, American Letters, giving her children Juan and Luz editorial control. Shortly afterward, she left for Europe, where she would remain until 1955. It has been suggested that an irreconcilable enmity between Edelmira and Eva Perón was the cause of this long exile. Nevertheless, many photographs from the period show the two women together at cocktail and birthday parties, receptions, opening nights, and sporting events. Evita, in all likelihood, could not get beyond page 10 of Poe's Room, and Edelmira would certainly not have approved of the First Lady's social background, but documents and letters written by third parties indicate that they had embarked upon shared projects, such as the creation of a major museum of contemporary Argentinian art, to be designed by Edelmira and the young architect Hugo Bossi, including artist residencies with a full catering service, a feature quite unique among the greater museums of the world, the aim being to facilitate the creative work and daily life of young and not-so-young exponents of modern painting and consequently to prevent their emigration to Paris or New York. Some people claim to have seen a film script drafted by the two ladies about the life and misfortunes of an innocent young Don Juan to be played by Hugo del Carril, but like so many other things, the draft has been lost. What we know for certain is that Edelmira did not return to Argentina until 1955, by which time the rising star in literary Buenos Aires was her daughter Luz Mendeluce. Edelmira's later years were not prolific. Apart from her collected poems, the first volume appeared in 1962, the second in 1979. She was to publish only three more books, a volume of memoirs, The Century as I Have Lived It in 1968, written with the help of the ever-faithful Carozzone, followed by a collection of very short stories, Churches and Cemeteries of Europe, 1972, distinguished by the author's abundant common sense, and finally, a gathering of unpublished early poems, Fervor, 1985. In her roles as patroness of the arts and promoter of young talent, however, Edelmira remained as active as ever. Countless volumes included a foreword, a preface, or an afterword by the widow Mendeluce. She also personally financed the first editions of innumerable works. Of the books for which she wrote prefaces, two deserve a special mention, Stale Hearts and Young Hearts by Julian Rico Anaya, a novel which provoked a heated controversy both in Argentina and abroad on its publication in 1978, and The Invisible Adorers by Carola Leiva, a collection of poems intended to put an end to the sterile poetry debate that had been going on in Argentinian circles since the Second Surrealist Manifesto. Among the books she subsidized, two titles stand out indisputably: The Kids of Puerto Argentino, a perhaps somewhat exaggerated memoir by the Falkland of the Falklands War, which catapulted the ex-soldier Jorge Esteban Petrovich to literary prominence, and The Darts and the Wind, an anthology of work by young, well-bred poets whose aesthetic objectives included avoiding cacophony, vulgar expressions, and ugly-sounding words, and which, with its preface by Juan Mendeluce, sold unexpectedly well. Edelmira spent the last 3 years of her life on her ranch in Azul, either in the Po Room, where she would doze and dream of the past, or out on the broad terrace of the main ranch house, absorbed in a book or contemplating the landscape. She remained lucid, or furious, as she liked to say, to the end. Roberto Bolaño, Nazi Literature in the Americas. It's halfway through my show. Good night, Norman. My name is Norman Douglas. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. Catskill, Hudson, Acre, New York. WGXC.org on the worldwide interweb. I'm going to try to squeeze in these things always take longer than I imagine that they're going to take, I'll tell you that. But I guess it's because one reads faster to oneself than one does aloud. And at times I do practice these things aloud, but then I might as well just record it out loud. I like this freewheeling feeling of not knowing if I'm going to get everything in there. Juan Mendeluce Thompson, the second piece in Roberto Bolaño's Nazi Literature in the Americas, translated by Chris Andrews. New Directions, paperback. Juan Mendeluce Thompson, Buenos Aires, 1920, Buenos Aires, 1991. As the second child of Edelmira Thompson, Juan realized at an early age that he could do whatever he liked with his life. He tried his hand at sports. He was a passable tennis player and an appalling race car driver. He patronized the arts, or rather fraternized with bohemians and criminals until prevented from doing so by his father and his vigorous older brother, whose prohibitions were backed up by threats and occasional violence. And he studied law before turning to literature. At the age of 20, he published his first novel, The Egoists, a tale of mystery and youthful exaltation set in London, Paris, and Buenos Aires. The events are precipitated by an apparently insignificant occurrence. A mild-mannered family man suddenly shouts at his wife, ordering her to take the children and leave the house immediately. Or put them in a room and lock the door. He then locks himself in the bathroom. After an hour, the woman emerges from the locked room in which she has obediently taken refuge, goes to the bathroom and finds her husband dead, with a razor in his hand and his throat slit. This suicide, which seems at first an open and shut case, is investigated by a Scotland Yard detective with a passion for spiritualism and by one of the dead man's sons. The investigation takes more than 15 years and serves as a pretext for introducing a gallery of characters, including a young French neo-royalist and a young German Nazi, who are allowed to discourse at length and seem to serve as the author's mouthpieces. The novel was a success. By 1943, four editions had sold out in Argentina, and sales were strong in Spain as well as in Chile, Uruguay, and other Latin American countries. But Juan Mendoluce decided to forego literature in favor of politics. For a time, he considered himself to be a phalangist and a follower of José Antonio Primo de Rivera. He was anti-USA and anti-capitalist. Later, he became a Peronist and held important government posts at the capital and in the province of Córdoba. His career in public service was impeccable. With the demise of Peronism, his political inclinations underwent a further transformation. He turned pro-USA. In fact, the Argentinian left accused him of publishing 25 CIA agents in his magazine, an exaggerated figure by any reckoning. Became a partner in one of the major legal firms in Buenos Aires and was finally appointed ambassador to Spain. On his return from Madrid, he published a novel, The Argentinian Horseman, in which he bewailed the spiritual poverty of the contemporary world, the decline of piety and compassion, and the incapacity of the modern novel, particularly in its crude and aimless French manifestations, to understand suffering and so create characters. He became known as the Argentinian Cato. He fought with his sister Luz Mendoluce over control of the family magazine. Having won the fight, he tried to lead a crusade against the lack of feeling in the contemporary novel. To coincide with the publication of his third novel, Springtime in Madrid, he launched a campaign against Francophilia, the cult of violence, atheism, and foreign ideas. American Letters and Modern Argentina served as his platforms, along with the various Buenos Aires dailies, which were keen to publish, although sometimes flabbergasted by, his denunciations of Cortázar, whom he described as unreal and bloodthirsty, and of Borges, whose stories, so he claimed, were parodies of parodies, and whose lifeless characters were derived from worn-out traditions of English and French literature, clearly in decline, repeating the same old plots ad nauseam. His attacks took him Bioy Casares, Mujica Laines, Ernesto Sabato, who in his eyes personified the cult of violence and gratuitous aggression, Leopoldo Marechal, and others. He was to publish three more novels, Youthful Ardor, a look back to the Argentina of 1940, Pedrito Saldana, The Patagonian, a story of adventures in the South, a cross between Stevenson and Conrad, and Luminous Obscurity, a novel about order and disorder, justice and injustice, God and the Void. In 1975, he gave up literature once again in favor of politics. He served the Peronist and military governments with equal loyalty. In 1985, after the death of his elder brother, he took over the running of the family businesses, a task he delegated to his nephews and his son in 1989 in order to work on a novel, which he did not finish. This last work, Sinking Islands, was published in a critical edition prepared by Edelmiro Carozzoni, the son of his mother's secretary. 50 pages. Conversations among indistinct characters and chaotic descriptions of an endless welter of rivers and seas. Two stories from Roberto Bolaño's Nazi Literature and the Americas. These stories don't all take place in Argentina. The blurb on the back I'll read to make it less biased presents itself as an encyclopedia of extremely right-wing writers composed of short biographies of imaginary pan-American authors. The nations with the most representatives are Argentina with 8 and the USA with 7. Nazi Literature in the Americas describes in 14 thematic sections the writers' lives, politics, and literary works. It includes biographies, cross-references, and an epilogue. Although the writers are invented, they're all carefully and credibly situated in real literary worlds. Bolaño's characters encounter Allen Ginsberg, Octavio Paz, and Lezama Lima. Remarkably inventive, chilling, and witty, Nazi Literature in the Americas offers keen insights into the workings of an extraordinarily fecund literary imagination. That's what the blurbers say on the back of Bolaño's book. That's all the explanation you'll get. Because now it's time for something from Andrew Lang's, editor Andrew Lang's, The Red Fairy Book. I figured if I was going to read about Nazis, I'd also read about commies. What could be more commie than red fairies? Or as they used to say back when I was a kid, commie pinko. It's after midnight. I could say that other word, but I'm not going to say it because it doesn't rhyme with fairy either, but it has the same pejorative connotation when referencing human sexuality. What was I going to read here? Oh, I know. The Voice of Death. This is not a New Directions book. It's a Dover book. Another fabulous paperback. These were picked up at a wonderful little, it wasn't that wonderful, but it was picked up at an estate sale. This guy had more history books. I think I would have hated to meet whoever it was. Because his history books were all kind of like, you know, I don't think I even saw Stephen Ambrose, so I wanted to say that, but they were like, what's his name? The Discoverers, that guy, Paul Johnson. They were that kind of thing, you know, the Tom Clancy historians, you know. You didn't even have Barbara Tuchman. I don't know. Anyways, this is The Voice of Death. It's a fairy tale. Once upon a time, there lived a man. Wait a minute, let me shift positions. Once upon a time, there lived a man whose one wish and prayer was to get rich. Once upon a time, there was the voice of death. Once upon a time, there lived a man whose one wish and prayer was to get rich. Let me read that sentence one more time because I don't think it might be a difficult concept for people to understand. Once upon a time, there lived a man whose one wish and prayer was to get rich. And this wasn't even in this book. I mean, this story comes from a time before the United States was conceived. And yet, once upon a time, there lived a man whose one wish and prayer was to get rich. Imagine that. Day and night he thought of nothing else. And at last his prayers were granted, and he became very wealthy. Now, being so rich and having so much to lose, he felt that it would be a terrible thing to die and leave all his possessions behind, so he made up his mind to set out in search of a land where there was no death. He got ready for his journey, took leave of his wife, and started. Whenever he came to a new country, the first question that he asked was whether people died in that land, and when he heard that they did, he set out again on his quest. At last he reached a country where he was told that the people did not even know the meaning of the word death. Our traveler was delighted when he heard this and said, "But surely there are great numbers of people in your land if no one ever dies." "No, no," they replied, "there are not great numbers, for you see, from time to time a voice is heard calling first one and then another, and whoever hears that voice gets up and goes away and never comes back." "And do they see the person who calls them?" he asked, "or do they only hear his voice?" "They both see and hear him," was the answer. Well, the man was amazed when he heard that the people were stupid enough to follow the voice, though they knew that if they went when it called, they would never return. He went back to his own home and got all his possessions together, and taking his wife and family, he set out resolved to go and live in that country where the people did not die, but where instead they heard a voice calling them, which they followed into a land from which they never returned. For he had made up his own mind that when he or any of his family heard that voice, they would pay no heed to it, however loudly it called. After he had settled down in his new home and had got everything in order about him, he warned his wife and family that unless they wanted to die, they must on no account listen to a voice which they might someday hear calling them. For some years everything went well with them, and they lived happily in their new home. But one day, while they were all sitting together around the table, his wife suddenly started up, exclaiming in a loud voice, "I'm coming! I'm coming!" And she began to look round the room for her fur coat. But her husband jumped up, and taking firm hold of her by the hand, held her fast and reproached her, saying, "Don't you remember what I told you? Stay where you are, unless you wish to die." "But don't you hear that voice calling me?" she answered. I'm not the best page turner, sorry. "I'm merely going to see why I'm wanted. I shall come back directly." So she fought and struggled to get away from her husband and to go where the voice summoned. But he would not let her go and had all the doors of the house shut and bolted. When she saw that he had done this, she said, "Very well, dear husband, I shall do what you wish and remain what I am." So her husband believed that it was all right and that she had thought better of it and had got over her mad impulse to obey the voice. But a few minutes later, she made a sudden dash for one of the doors, opened it, and darted out, followed by her husband. He caught her by the fur coat and begged and implored her not to go, for if she did, she would certainly never return. She said nothing, but let her arms fall backwards, and suddenly bending herself forward, she slipped out of the coat, leaving it in her husband's hands. He, poor man, seemed turned to stone as he gazed after her hurrying away from him and calling at the top of her voice as she ran, "I'm coming! I am coming!" When she was quite out of sight, her husband recovered his wits and went back into his house, murmuring, "Is she so foolish as to wish to die? Can't help it. I warned and implored her to pay no heed to that voice, however loudly it might call." Well, days and weeks and months and years passed, and nothing happened to disturb the peace of the household. But one day the man was at the barber's, as usual, being shaved. The shop was full of people, and his chin had just been covered with a lather of soap, when suddenly, starting up from the chair, he called out in a loud voice, I won't come, do you hear? I won't come. The barber and the other people in his shop listened to him with amusement. But again, looking towards the door, he exclaimed, I tell you once and for all, I do not mean to come, so go away. And a few minutes later, he called out again, Go away, I tell you, or it'll be the worse for you. You may call as much as you like, but you'll never get me to come. And he got so angry that you might have thought that someone was actually standing at the door, tormenting him. At last he jumped up and caught the razor out of the barber's hand, exclaiming, Give me that razor and I'll teach him to let people alone for the future. And he rushed out of the house as if he were running after someone whom no one else saw. The barber, determined not to lose his razor, pursued the man, and they both continued running at full speed till they had got well out of the town, when all of a sudden the man fell head foremost down a precipice and never was seen again. So he too, like the others, had been forced against his will to follow the voice that called him. The barber, who went home whistling and congratulating himself on the escape he had made, described what had happened, and it was noised abroad in the country that the people who had gone away and had never returned had all fallen into that pit, for till then they had never known what had happened to those who had heard the voice and obeyed its call. But when crowds of people went out from the town to examine the ill-fated pit that had swallowed up such members and yet never seemed to be full, they could discover nothing. All that they could see was a vast plain that looked as if it had been there since the beginning of the world. And from that time the people of the country began to die like ordinary mortals all the world over. Apparently this tale is a Romanian one, according to the editor, Andrew Lang of the Red Fairy Book. That was a good short communist story. How did Red go from being commie to... was it now? MAGA? How did that happen? I really don't like them taking my name, my colors from me. Do you think, I guess the Crips and the Bloods, but I guess it's not really political. And the Red Scare of the commies goes back way before any of us were born. All right, I'll shut up. I mean, I won't shut up, but I'll stop editorializing. All right, I'm going to continue the saga of the fascist. It didn't really seem... I mean, I guess... I would never finish that story. Okay. Oh, this ill-fated airtime. Talk about something political. I've done that before, but I don't really feel like anything political right now. I mean, these are all basically the same as the Italian folk tales. Compiled by Calvino. All right, I'm going to do Mother Holla. I don't really think I'll get through it, but I'm going to try. It's one of the shortest in the books, and I've actually read it. Now I just have to find page 303 in my unabridged edition of Andrew Lang's Red Fairy Book right here on WGXC.org. Radio for Open Ears. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman. Name of your host, Norman Douglas. I'm having a really hard time finding this page because I'm doing it one-handed. All right, Mother Holla. Because I'm trying to hold this microphone in my face. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to finish this story, but I'm going to start it. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in and what's the date today? The 20th, so 14 days will be the 34th. So tune in 2 weeks. It'll be May. And I'm going to try to find a May Day story, even though it won't be May Day. But I suspect I'll go for some Paul Average. We'll see. Mother Holla. Once upon a time, there was a widow who had 2 daughters. One of them was pretty and clever, and the other ugly and lazy. But as the ugly one was her own daughter, she liked her far the best of the two. And the pretty one had to do all the work of the house, and was in fact the regular maid of all work. Every day she had to sit by a well on the high road and spin till her fingers were so sore that they often bled. One day some drops of blood fell on her spindle, so she dipped it into the well, meaning to wash it, but as luck would have it, it dropped from her hand and fell right in. She ran weeping to her stepdaughter and told her what had happened. But she was scolded harshly, as merciless in anger. Stepmother was so merciless in her anger that she said, "Well, since you dropped the spindle down, you must just go after it yourself and don't let me see your face again until you bring it with you." Then the poor girl returned to the well, and not knowing what she was about, in the despair and misery of her heart, she sprang into the well and sank to the bottom. For a time she lost all consciousness, and when she came to herself again, she was lying in a lovely meadow with the sun shining brightly overhead and 1,000 flowers blossoming at her feet. She rose up and wandered through this enchanted place till she came to a baker's oven full of bread, and the bread called out to her as she passed. "Oh, take me out, or I shall be burnt to a cinder. I am quite done enough." So she stepped up quickly to the oven and took out all the loaves, one after the other. Then she went a little further on and... Then she went on a little farther and came to a tree laden with beautiful, rosy-cheeked apples. As she passed this by, it called out, "Oh, shake me, my apples are all quite ripe." So she did as she was asked and shook the tree till the apples fell. None were left hanging. When she had gathered them all up into a heap, she went on her way again and came at length to a little house, at the door of which sat an old woman. The old dame had such large teeth that the girl felt frightened and wanted to run away, but the old woman called after, "What are you afraid of?"